Welcome to the NutGallery.com podcast. Today we're interviewing Kyle Higgins, writer-director of The League. Maybe start out by talking a little bit about your film, The League. And
the movie started about exactly 2 years ago when I was in Chicago for Christmas time with actually my friend who's my roommate right now, Alex Siegel, was back as well, and we started talking about writing this short film that I had an idea for previously about a superhero labor union in Chicago. And I knew at that point that I was going to be doing a thesis film the following fall at Chapman University when I was going into my final year. So I decided I wanted to do something a little bit larger on a bigger scale. I've kind of said a couple times now that film school is such a cliche these days that if you want to do anything that, or if you want any shot at get standing out or getting your work noticed, you kind of have to go outside the box a little bit. And the fact that superhero movies were and are a big draw currently didn't hurt the decision. But my kind of interest in film really started with Superman when I was very young, the Donner version. So it seemed like a nice circle to do, you know, the genre that got me into to work in that same genre for my final, film project of my college career.
Why don't you touch a little bit on the superhero characters that you have in there?
Sure. As it's pretty obvious, all the characters are based on established superheroes in the Marvel and DC universes. And just the DC universe. And that was a decision that Alec and I made really early on where, short films are very tough to do, especially short films that have any sort of plot. I mean, I've kind of always said that you can either film with a driving story and very weak characters, or you can have a film with great characters that do absolutely nothing, and it's kind of, in a lot of ways, a pick your poison, because it's just the medium is so hard to do both, and at the same time, you just don't have enough time. And I mean, we pushed really hard, and we're at 27 minutes with the film, and even that's not enough time. So, by using characters as springboards to then tell our story, established characters, I should say. It worked really well in developing kind of a shorthand for the audience. You see the Gray Raven and Sparrow, you immediately get the Batman and Robin connotation. You know what the characters are like or what they're supposed to be like. And then it kind of saves you a lot of time in a lot of ways. And then also it's kind of the Watchmen factor with using kind of established archetype characters for to then, kind of tell your own altered take on them.
You spoke of pushing on this project. You also had, I had read that this was the largest project in Chapman University history.
That's probably unofficial. I was told that from a couple professors in terms of scope. But I don't know. I mean, I know there's another project or two I can think of that were pretty large. I would probably say just in terms of the complexity of the shoot as well as the post-production process, really all three phases, the pre-production, the production, the post-production, challenging. And I was very, very fortunate to have extremely talented people surrounding me for all three phases of the film. I had some of the really the best producers at the school in Michael Campbell and Ozzy Ochertsky, and then during production, Andrew Davis, who shot the film beautifully, had just won the ASC award for best student cinematography. So he's a very, very much a rising star in that world. In conjunction with Mike Greer, well, the Greers in general, Mike and Josh Greer, who did a lot of the they worked with Dorothy Street, the production designer, during production to, you know, really create this world and make it feel as authentic as possible and not like, you know, a bad student set, which I don't think it feels that way at all. Well, in terms of dressing them and really, you know, bringing out kind of the gritty nature of it and trying to really help us capture that. And then in post-production, Mike Greer and Josh Greer, as well as Danny Padrone, did all the visual effects for the movie, basically. There were a couple other people, including Justin Lutzky, and Adam Rote, who helped out and did a number of shots. But without, like I said, without those people surrounding me through the different processes, there's no way we would have been able to tackle something this large. Because, like I said, shooting the movie is only one aspect. Finishing it is another. There's this whole other world involved in a movie like this with post-production, as I'm sure a lot of people know who are fans of superhero films.
When you look back on this project and realize the scope that you pulled off in a very short time and very limited money, how do you look back on that?
Well, to be honest, it's still fairly fresh. I mean, I really didn't finish the movie until about a month ago, like 100% done in the can, finished doing all the tweaks. But I'm proud of it. I'm very proud of it. It was extremely hard, and it was at times it didn't look like it was gonna happen. As most things at times, you know, most films at certain points in their production or their post-production look as if they will never get done. And there were definitely moments like that on this film, in pre-production with the money or during production with locations or actors falling out or post-production with just technical dilemmas and problems that we had no idea how to solve. For example, with the post-production, we did the entire film, we did a digital intermediate workflow for this film at Chapman University. And basically, we were doing all of our film was scanned at Chapman on a DataCine machine, a Spirit 4K machine. And then we were obviously working in the computer for both editing and visual effects. However, to do visual effects with footage that's been scanned on the particular scanner that Chapman has, there is a inherent jitter to the footage that's basically imperceptible to the eye until you on top of the footage. So basically there's this slight jitter that there's no way to stabilize it, there's no way to track it, and it really tied us up for a couple months until I called around to some post-production houses in Los Angeles and worked out a deal with one, E-Film, where they actually re-scanned all of our visual effects plates, all of our shots that needed visual effects, so there was no jitter. They had a different type of scanner there that's called a pin-registered scanner that would take care of that for us. Sorry, that long
no,
tangent
no,
there.
No, that's fine.
So the question was, looking back on it, right, okay. Yeah, it was definitely, in a lot of ways, probably too ambitious of a project for us, but at the same time, well, it was too ambitious of a project for us to know what the script was and what we were trying to do. We obviously came up short of that, like any film normally does, but the fact that we even got 75 or 80% of what we were trying to do is really something, you know, especially at a student level. So it's something that, you know, for all its flaws, I think everyone that was involved in it is very proud of the work that came out of it.
Now, you picked 1946 Chicago as your setting. Why did you pick that, and what challenges did that present?
Well, we picked 46 for the opening, and then we transition about, you know, a minute and a half, 2 minutes into the film to the early 60s. In our minds, it was kind of 1963 before Kennedy got shot. And we originally picked the 40s, and the 40s were kind of a byproduct of the fact that we wanted to set the main storyline of the film in the 1960s. So the reason we picked the 60s, well, there were a couple of reasons. The first is Silver Age comic book characters are always very fascinating to me. That in conjunction with the labor union aspect and the fact that we wanted to set the film in Chicago made it kind of a very logical progression in terms of deciding the time period. So it was the 60s was a great fit for, like I said, the labor union angle, as well as the Silver Age comic book characters, as well as the style of the film. We wanted to shoot it as a, you know, like a noir. And from there, we knew we wanted to open the film some 20 years earlier, juxtapose the differences in the league from when it started to where it is now. And so I think so it came out to being 1946 where we opened. In terms of challenges for the 40s, luckily we only had the one sequence, the newsreel footage. And actually all that footage was shot on the XX Kodak stock, which is a black and white, very grainy film stock. But in terms of setting it in the city then in the 40s, that obviously is challenging because the city doesn't look like it did in the 40s. So my other roommate, Michael Nye, who is from Wisconsin, was in Chicago about a year ago while I was home for Christmas break. And so we went to Fletcher, Chicago, and rented an Arri SR3 package, in basically 10-degree temperatures and snow, shooting everything we could. Very guerrilla filmmaking, no permits, almost got arrested. But that aside, we got some spectacular footage for that newsreel, as well as for our 1960 sequences. All the shots, the establishing shots of the league offices are the Palm Olive building in the Loop, the North Loop. And we actually talked our way up to the 45th floor of the John Hancock building with the camera package to get those high-angle shots looking down on the city.
I actually have a question that was submitted by one of our fans in regards back to the superheroes in the film.
Sure.
He wanted to know the inspiration or a little bit more about the ringslinger Blue Blaze. And he wanted to know if it was a Hal Jordan or a John Stewart-inspired character.
Oh, for the Blaze character?
Yes.
I'm not sure I would say either. That character originally started as someone who believed so strongly in the league and the cause that they were fighting for that he, obviously there's kind of, you could find the John Stewart inspiration with, both characters being African-American. But I wasn't really thinking about that when we wrote the script. It's actually strange. I actually didn't have a race in mind ever for Blaze. And so when Jackie Salito, who was our casting director, was asking me about trying to diversify our cast a little bit, she is the one who brought up the idea, well, how would you feel about making Blaze black? And I said I thought that was a great idea, and at that point is when I said, well, obviously there's John Stewart, which is, a direct kind of, people will find a relation to that, or see the connection there. But the idea of 1960 Chicago with an African-American superhero was really intriguing to me, and we had some more story elements about that in the script that unfortunately we had to cut out in the editing room. But the idea of what would it be like the only black superhero in 1960 Chicago is pretty interesting to me. So that's kind of where that came from. But in terms of a direct inspiration from Hal Jordan or John Stewart, it was more just the Green Lantern idea in general.
He also wanted to know if you were going to make another film, if you'd consider a Blue Beetle inspired character.
A Blue Beetle.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually not that familiar with Blue Beetle. I'm sorry to say. The Blue Beetle was the inspiration for Night Owl in Watchmen, right?
I believe so, yes.
I know there's a scarab in there somewhere. Yeah, I'm not opposed to it. I would just have to learn more about the Blue Beetle.
maybe also before we that's the end of his questions. Maybe talk a little bit about the cast and how you happened to get the
sure.
cast that you did.
Well, we put out a casting call. Like I said, Jackie Salito was, and I can email you all these names if you want any spelling clarifications. Jackie Salito was our casting director, and she had graduated from Chapman a year before me and gotten into the casting world, I believe, as an assistant. And she put out a casting call on a couple different services, I think Breakdown Express and LA Casting. And it's very common for student actors, student films especially in Los Angeles, to use SAG actors. And there's basically a waiver agreement with SAG where you can use SAG actors for no charge if they agree to working on the project. Much larger project in scope, and it also had kind of a unique take on superheroes, and to be frank, there aren't very many student superhero projects out there, so I think we had like 300 replies for the main character, the Wraith, and another 300 or 400 replies for the Grey Raven. And so we kind of sorted through that and held a couple days of casting in Los Angeles and then narrowed it down to a handful of people and brought those people down to Orange County the following weekend to do chemistry readings against each other. And so we, arrived on our cast completely out of their interest in the project, really. We didn't go after anyone who submitted that was interested. And we lucked out, really. I mean, because some of the people, I mean, Rick is a fantastic actor who played the Grey Raven, who's been working as an actor for 18 years now. And he has a number of credits to his name. I know he's been in a series of episodes on The West Wing, and he was in G.I. Jane. And then Camden, who played Nikolai Lenin, he's best known as one of the gentlemen from the Hush episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I think he's played like 4 or 5 villains on that show, as well as on Angel. So it's definitely, we're very fortunate in terms of the caliber of talent that we got for the short. So,
all right. I know you're a big fan of the 78 version of Superman. What did you think of the Superman Returns?
That's a tricky one for me. The movie's well done, but it had too many strikes against it for me just going into the theater. I wasn't a big fan of the costume, which is more related to the overall production design of the movie, where it's a pseudo, 40s kind of throwback, but modern day, and then it's supposed to be a sequel, but not really. It's a sequel with a younger cast that ignores some Superman movies but not others, and some plot lines and not others, and it was just a very weird amalgam of ideas. Not to mention that Superman doesn't really hit anyone or anything in the movie. So it definitely didn't that's really all I could say about it. But it was interesting because I did obviously see the Richard Donner's Superman 2 cut, which just made me wish they would have let him finish that film back in 1978. Can only imagine what it would have been like, to see what him and Tom Mankiewicz would have come up with for the end. It would be a completely different film than what was released. So.
All right. Well, do you have any other projects you're going to be working on in the near future?
I have a couple things that I'm developing, that I'm writing, and I just there are a couple scripts I'm trying to develop to direct. signed on with representation at with Jeff Morley from Management 360 and Adam Weinstein and Julian Thuan at UTA. So it's very early in terms of taking meetings. Or I've been just kind of taking meetings around town and talking about different projects that I'm interested in doing features mostly. I am trying to do The League as a graphic novel right now. There's a much larger story than what was in The Short, and I think the world is very interesting to and there's a lot for Alec and I to explore in that. So that's kind of all I can really say right now.
I understand.
I don't want to jinx anything. So
yeah, I understand that. I think that's an incredible idea with the graphic novel, though. I hope that takes off.
Yeah, I'm excited about it because as a graphic novel, telling our story that we want to work with, as a graphic novel, I really think that it's the best medium for it. Because what's really interesting about the idea is the world. And so doing it as, you know, Alec and I have a treatment for a feature film version of The League, and it's just not as, it just doesn't quite work. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that a feature film is a very linear storytelling medium. You know, you sit in a theater for 2 hours, and you have 2 hours to tell your story. Whereas a graphic novel, and in a lot of ways a television show, there's much more freedom there. You know, it's more of a chapter approach, where you can basically go explore different areas of the world, different characters. You can tell an entire issue. It's just a much more free form medium. So I think it's a good fit.